Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here or for listening to this radio show recorded at L'Ascenseur, organized in the context of our weekly radio shows, but also in the context of our current exhibition on Afghanistan presented until November 28th. Today, we're talking to Bojan Savic, lecturer in international relations at the University of Kent, Russell School of International Studies. We'll be talking about his book, Afghanistan Under Siege, The Afghan Body and a Post-Colonial Border. Thank you very much for accepting our invitation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Nadine. Thank you, Geopolis. And thanks, everyone.
So for your book published in June 2020, just a year before the Taliban's takeover of Kabul made the front pages of almost all international media, you traveled to Herat, Afghanistan for various months in 2015 and 16 to analyze the impact of post-colonial security on the daily lives and experiences of Afghan citizens. As an academic researcher specialized in critical security studies and post-colonial studies, what triggered your interest in Afghanistan? Why did you decide to study the country?
That's an excellent question. I discovered my interest in Afghanistan it came from a variety of directions. One was just the dissatisfaction with the state of academia, especially my discipline, international relations and security studies, and the way they did or did not talk about ordinary people in Afghanistan. Even the sort of critical academics who are skeptical of Western or global interventionism, humanitarian intervention, state building, even their works insufficiently paid really attention to what ordinary people do on a daily basis in the sense of how do they cope with the really an avalanche of international organizations, troops, you know, foreign bankers, NGO activists, officials, and bureaucrats with an onslaught of private security companies of funding that came from all kinds of sources in the world and really radically shifted how regular people live and how it changes their daily decisions. And so it partially just came from that stunning realization that was like that I just couldn't read enough voices from Afghanistan. And on the other hand, my dissatisfaction with my own research previously, with my PhD that was about really very NATO focused. And then I realized Afghanistan features so prominently in NATO's post Cold War transformation and how the global alliance reinvented itself. And especially in 2000s, you know, the word Afghanistan, the country, the people was in everyone's mouth and all kinds of strategic documents. And yet, like I said, again, regular people were missing. And so, yeah, I think those were two major sources of my dissatisfaction that led me to then decide, first of all, ask myself a question. Okay, so you're not getting a lot from academics and the policy world, you know, NATO world, security world doesn't really talk about ordinary Afghans. So where do you find this voice? How do you hear this voice out? And I came up with the most obvious response to that question. Well, pack up your bags and go to Afghanistan and then meet people.
Yeah. And you decided to go to Herat, which is the most western province of Afghanistan next to Iran. Why did you choose to specifically focus on this province?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I wanted to spend some time in Kabul as well, but and I did on both visits during both visits. But Kabul itself wasn't my center of attention. I focused on Herat because, well, first of all, because a lot of international academic scholars are really focused on Kabul. It did attract most attention in global academia. So I wanted to look somewhere else. And I was very dissatisfied with the sort of representations of certain places in Afghanistan, like, say, Helmand Province and Helmand River Valley, because they already had a certain congealed representation in global academia, in the media. You know, Helmand was this particularly deviant place that drugs and warlords and violence came out of. And I thought for a while, you know, fighting, you know, tilting at that particular windmill But then I decided that Herat in the west of the country was really interesting because as a relatively stable and sort of, you know, very hard security terms, as a relatively stable province, it had attracted a lot of foreign aid and quite a bit of foreign investment as well. And so in that sense, it was an interesting space within Afghanistan where you could really look at what happens to regular people when money that is given to them conditionally and not really given to them, but put in their living spaces under certain conditions and can easily be taken away. What happens when money and then white people that come with that money, how they reshape ordinary people's lives, just because the extent of that kind of influx of, like I said, aid, investments, you know, foreign intergovernmental organization officials, but also NGO officials, it was substantive in Herat. And it also fascinated me as a city with a really, really long history that captured just how different Afghanistan is from how the globe and the West imagine Afghanistan to be, right? Because when most people in the world think about Afghanistan, they think of this sort of fairly mainstream representation of tribal, somewhat violent people who just can't get their act together, really, and you know, run their country in some sort of a functional way. But then you look at Herat and you see, you know, a very old urban culture with very old institutions, arts, architecture, archaeological sites. And you also see people who are not, you know, the globe tends to equate Afghanistan with Pashtuns. Pashtuns are actually not a majority there. The language spoken is Dari. It is a dialect of Farsi. And, you know, everyday culture, everyday lives are very different. So Herat is an amazing case study into just how little we know about Afghanistan, because we mostly associate the discourse of Afghan patriotism with Pashtuns, and particularly with rural Pashtun populations, right? That's a stereotype that was particularly attractive to the West and the global media, because rural Pashtuns tend to talk about their lives you know, in a way that is very easy to twist. Oh, look at them. They're backwards. They're uber religious. They don't care about women. They don't care about children. And all of that is a caricature to begin with. But then you go to a place like Herat and you just see this imagination of Afghanistan fall apart, right? Because people just don't talk the same way.
Yeah, indeed. You just talked about the image of Afghanistan in general. In the first chapters of your book, you discuss this a lot, and you explain indeed how Afghanistan, within the discourse of global stability and the global war on terror, have been portrayed as unstable, backward, also risky for international security. You also trace this representation back to the beginning of the 19th century. To what extent is the image that we have nowadays or back in 2001 comparable to the image which was portrayed in the beginning of the 19th century? Is it still in line with the image back then?
Yeah, it is very interesting. Obviously, the context is different now. Afghanistan has been globalized in some ways, and there are some academics who talk about that in particular, about Afghanistan as a global nation, in the sense that it attracts a lot of attention in all different corners of the world. And whether you're in Brazil or in Australia or in Russia, everyone has an image, right? An imagination of Afghanistan. So in that sense, it is a global place. And so that context is different. But what is common to Afghanistan, to the sort of representations of Afghanistan now and in the 19th century, is that how ordinary people around the world outside of Afghanistan, how they see Afghans, is really intertwined with imperial imaginations, right? So how ordinary Brits who read the newspapers in the 19th century, which was still a fairly narrow sliver of the population, how they saw back then the kingdom of Kabul, as they called it, and then how, you know, Russian elites saw it, and then over time how Americans started to get interested in Afghanistan. This was all filtered through the imperial imagination, which means a certain place in the world matters only insofar as it is useful to empire or maybe dangerous, right? So what does it do for us? And that lens, that imperial imagination, right? That lens in particular shaped Afghanistan in the 19th century. Fascination and fear were really closely intertwined. And you can see that once you add the revolution in the 1970s to that, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and the enormous levels of armed resistance to Soviet occupation in the 80s, you bear in mind who weaponized, who armed the Afghan Mujahideen. To a large extent, it was America and her allies, right? And so you added all of those layers of warfare and violence over the years, and this is what Afghanistan collapses into. It collapses onto itself, right? It just becomes a caricature of itself, right? All of these nuances just become a sort of a reflection of a violent society, supposedly. And in the book, I talk about how Afghanistan is imagined, yes, as dangerous for the world. They are, you know, they're all these things that we read about. They're supposedly all terrorists. They're violent, but they're also migrants, right? All of these stereotypes that are fed to people, I wish I could say only through the media, but no, it's also through academic literature. They become congealed in what the Afghan is.
And then coming back to the discourse that was used by the U.S. When they started intervention in Afghanistan in 2001, which a lot of those things that you just mentioned indeed come together. Afghanistan is dangerous, at the same time also backward compared to Western countries. To illustrate, let's just listen to an extract of George W. Bush's speech on October 7, 2001, when the U.S. started invading Afghanistan.
By destroying camps and disrupting communications, we will make it more difficult for the terror network to train new recruits and coordinate their evil plans. Initially, the terrorists may burrow deeper into caves and other entrenched hiding places. Our military action is also designed to clear the way for sustained, comprehensive, and relentless operations to drive them out and bring them to justice. At the same time, the oppressed people of Afghanistan will know the generosity of America and our allies. As we strike military targets, we will also drop food, medicine, and supplies to the starving and suffering men and women and children of Afghanistan. The United States of America is a friend to the Afghan people, and we are the friends of almost a billion worldwide who practice the Islamic faith. The United States of America is an enemy of those who aid terrorists and of the barbaric criminals who profane a great religion by committing murder in its name.
So for the book, you indeed analyzed American, but also British, French, EU, NATO, and UN declarations on security strategy on Afghanistan. So how have these dominant discourses on Afghanistan then helped to justify also security strategies and interventions?
Yeah, speeches like this, and then a whole plethora of successive strategic documents, you know, from the EU, NATO, and their member states, and then UN Security Council resolutions. What I think they did crucially is they normalized the idea. They made it seem like it is absolutely acceptable to never question what is Afghanistan really like. They normalized the idea that Afghanistan is obviously violent. It's obviously dangerous. What these very ritualistic repetitions of, you know, both, you know, 9/11, say, testimonies, but also imageries, the planes crashing into the World Trade Center, Pentagon, and then later on, terror attacks in Madrid, repetitions of those stories. What they did, it created this sense that it needed and still doesn't need, you know, needs no proof to say that that Afghanistan can hurt you. Right. But it went a step further. They also normalized the idea that Afghans are dangerous for themselves. And this is something, you know, this idea that post-colonial peoples, something has happened to them in history or in their genes. You know, a lot of people are agnostic, supposedly. You know, we don't know where it comes from. But they, yes, they can hurt us, but they can also hurt themselves through their, you know, petty little civil wars. Through their, through how they violate, you know, supposedly human rights, what they do to their women and children, how they run, and by the way, these things all in these policy, mainstream policy discourses, all of these things matter way less than one common thing, which is how do they run the economy? Right? That is a primary discourse. So the economic struggles of Afghanistan are then used to show that they're incapable of, you know, doing just about anything, right? So in addition to all of that violence, you know, this trope that was being repeated that they're dangerous, not just to the world, but also to themselves. And if we want to save them from themselves, then we have to be there, right? That is what that imagination of Afghanistan does. It incites action. It makes, it gets, inspires even well-meaning liberals and progressives and lefties in the world to say, oh, we need to be in Afghanistan to protect A, B, and C, right? Women, children, and whoever. Never mind that there's actually never been any evidence that anyone's military presence in Afghanistan did anything for children and women in a sustained way, other than often make them more vulnerable and expose them to drone attacks, night raids, bombing campaigns, so on and so forth. But again, that required no proof. They're dangerous. They're incapable. We bring the, you know, we bring peace about in the world. We act on behalf of the normal world against the abnormal, which is in Afghanistan. So therefore, we need to be there. Right? That's just, it created this sort of automated logical connection between a representation and then a policy action that followed. If you're dangerous, then you need to be made less dangerous. If you're risky for yourself, then you need to be restrained. That is what 20 years of occupation in Afghanistan tried to do, to restrain Afghans so they wouldn't hurt themselves, supposedly. What it did, though, is it disempowered them in the process, poisoning Afghan politics in a way that made ordinary people each other's enemies, really, threatened their livelihoods in the long run, constrained what kind of politics they could or could not do, businesses could or could not run, and so on and so forth. So this is how, one of the points of the book is how very granular, very intimate, the impact of global security is in Afghanistan, right? Once I say that you are dangerous to yourself, I will make, you know, quote unquote, security happen for you in ways that are very intrusive. So NATO, the EU, United States will now be interested in children's rights, in women's rights in specific towns and cities. They will be funding these different initiatives, right? Often without any follow-up or follow-through or really reflection on how it changed ordinary people's lives, right? Often it made them a target. Often inserting money into communities where, you know, people are short on money actually fosters conflict, you know, fosters competition for resource, deepens local inequalities, right? The general representation led to the idea that we need to intervene in every little pore of society to make it better, to fix it. Because obviously they cannot fix it themselves.
And then indeed coming back to the impacts of security governance on the daily lives of Afghans themselves, the purpose of your book as well to show how this impacted really their personal experiences. So you showed also how they have used nonviolent strategies actually to resist to this security policies. Three case studies. One of them in Herat City, you interviewed amongst others military police, intelligence officers, NGO representatives, journalists. You identified a nonviolent strategy to security governance, which you described as milking the cow. What this means.
Milking the cow is sort of how ordinary people and often lower level military or police recruits or others who in some capacity ended up working for the Afghan National Security Forces, say, as I say in the book, as pharmacists, as translators, as admin bureaucrats, right? All kinds of ways engaged with security forces. Milking the cow is how they responded to this influx of foreign funding to supposedly fix Afghanistan, but in reality, to pacify Afghanistan, right? The same way you pacify a child when you give them a pacifier, you know, that's what I observed was happening there. You know, give them some money, open up some NGOs, some businesses, start something, create some jobs. Keep them busy over there so they wouldn't come over here, right? And so that was the logic, right? And so, you know, once you have all these foreigners present, you know, as troops, soldiers, NGO workers, foreign investors in your cities And once there's this influx of money that is not really meant for you, millions of dollars that went into Afghanistan were not really meant for Afghans. They were meant to start a business, for instance, in the best of versions, right? Start a business that will get some people employed. But when you actually look at how these businesses are, like how capital circulates, very few people benefited from it, right? There's someone busy running a business, but they can still barely feed a family off of it. They could be doing other things that they could be barely feeding their family off of, right? But they're now running a business. They're now involved in this very modern activity, right? That's just one example. Another example, obviously, where money goes into Afghanistan and Afghans don't benefit from it is, you know, when it is there to supply American or NATO troops, right? Or buy different kinds of equipment for them, get them the local logistic support to maintain the military bases, camps, the roads, all of this sort of conglomerate of things around what you need to occupy a country. And so then the ordinary Afghans looked at that, you know, a lot of these people who work for national security forces, and they said, wait a minute, there's all this money that's swirling around the country, that's circulating, and I have nothing to do. Like, I don't benefit from it at all. They need Afghanistan to sort of keep spending this money on security, right? It's kind of messed up. But I don't get to benefit from it. How do I benefit from it? You had actual Afghans, you know, keeping the books, making sure, you know, money exchanged hands, but it didn't really end up with anyone substantively, right? And so they started coming up with all these different tactics, how to skim, you know, some money on the side and how to steal really from NATO, US troops and other NATO member states through different practices that for the West, they were corrupt, they were illegal. For the locals, they were, you know what? You never asked me if I wanted you to be here in the first place. You came. You are here. You're saying you're providing security for me. I still am not sure if I want you here, but you know what? At least I can do something. I can take advantage of you. I can milk the cow, right? That was the representation of the sort of NATO and the global security apparatus in Herat. And they came up with all kinds of little tactics to pilfer and engage in sort of petty theft and keep some of those precious dollars, right, for themselves. Now, obviously, NATO, US government, they hated it. But for ordinary Afghans, you know, that was kind of one of the things they could do. So you had this practice of ghost soldiering, right? Making up soldiers on the payroll, writing down people's names, dates of birth, fake IDs, you know. Whereas in reality, a lower level, a bookkeeper, an administrator in the military or in the police, they would actually pocket the pay for this soldier that doesn't really exist, right? That was the ghost soldiering. One of the things that I think U.S. Department of Defense hated the most, right? It, because they saw it as Afghanistan sucking dollars dry from the United States. Whereas in reality, there were so many other things that were wrong with this intervention. You know, Afghans keeping some money on the side is the least of your worries. But that was an example of milking the cow.
And how was this like financially benefiting from the security system? Why did you describe it as a strategy or resistance strategy? Why is it different from just living your life in the conditions that they have?
Very often that's what it was. Very often people were just living their lives, going on with their daily routines and using whatever resources they had around them to, you know, as I say, improve their life chances, you know, get a better shot at a better life. And a lot of people didn't have this clear idea, oh, I'm going to steal from the United States so that I make them miserable and make their time in Afghanistan miserable. And I will steal from them as a way of undermining U.S. presence in Afghanistan. No, people I spoke to didn't have these lofty political goals. They just said, well, I need to feed my family. There don't seem to be too many jobs around. These NATO people and these Americans are here. They got some money, but that's a resource that I can use. So it was not an act of sort of heroic resistance, subversion of occupation, but it did frustrate the global security apparatus in Afghanistan. It did frustrate the way sort of the missions, US and NATO missions were run in the country, right? It did make things more complicated for them. And it did drive home the point that Afghans are not just some compliant little population, an equation, a little problem that you can solve. They're real people and they have real life aspirations and they will do whatever they have to do to survive. And if you're just going to ignore them, if you're going to talk past them, and if you're going to just tell them, I'm here to keep you safe from yourself and to keep the world safe from you, you're not going to get very far with that. Right? And they didn't get very far with that. In that sense, there was an act of resistance, not because it wanted to subvert the United States and its presence in Afghanistan, but it just wanted to live on its own terms as best as they could. And living on your own terms, when the entire world is interested in making sure that you, as an ordinary Afghan man or woman, never get to leave the country. But if you, because if you do leave the country, you're then a dangerous immigrant. So when you have a whole world invested in making sure you stay there, and when you have troops, economists, administrators, bureaucrats, NGO folk from the entire world flocking your country, making sure they run some part of it, they control some part of it, you do what you have to survive. And ironically, it ends up having this kind of a resistant effect. It pushes back. It changes the way global security gets to control Afghanistan or, in fact, not control it.
Okay. And then you also mentioned migration, the fact that for Afghans, it's very or almost impossible to leave the country. For your research, you also focused on the experiences of Afghans crossing the border with Iran at Islam Qala, one of the most important border crossings in the country and the largest leading into Iran. This border crossing also repeatedly made the international media for the restrictive measures, but also for allegations of abuse and violence at the border. We'll first listen to an extract of a media report.
Here at Islam Qala, hundreds of Afghans cross the border every day. Some come home voluntarily, but many have been deported by Iran, forced onto buses, and sent back here.
Ismail's hands were painted red in an Iranian jail to identify him as a prisoner. He says his only crime was asking for his salary.
I am deported and the wages from 5 months of work are still there. If our stomachs were full, why would we go to Iran? Why would we choose misery?
Sent back with him are teenagers that the international community calls children. Their Afghan families see them as breadwinners. Like 15-year-old Noor Mohammed Karimi.
My employer didn't pay me. He fired me. Then he turned me over to the police. And then they deported me.
Despite the mistreatment, many Afghans will try to go back, paying smugglers hundreds of dollars to return to Iran in search of work.
So, yeah, this was a report by Al Jazeera published on November 24, 2013. So why did you choose to focus on Islam Qala as the place to conduct this research on nonviolent resistances to global security structures at the border with Iran? You can also say it's mostly controlled by Iran. So why is this an important place also when you study global security and the impact of Afghan lives?
Great question, honestly. I think Islam Qala is, I was interested in it because normally in mainstream global security rhetoric, you get this juxtaposition between Iran and global security, right? They pursue nuclear weapons. They finance terrorists. They help, dictators, right, in the region. And so therefore, they're dangerous also. Iranians, right? They're dangerous. The regime is dangerous for the world. But what you see at Islam Qala is actually that Iran is very helpful to global security, the way global security imagines itself. Global security is the protection of something nebulous out there. It doesn't really matter what's being protected. What really matters is who it's being protected from. It's the other of global security that matters. And in this case, that's the dangerous Afghan. And so for as long as Iran can keep Turkey, Greece, and then further out west, European Union nations, right? As long as Iran can help keep them safe from Afghan immigrants, Iran is very helpful, actually, to global security, right? So very counterintuitively, you see at this very sort of fairly small place, right, this border crossing, you see Iran as playing a very important constructive role for any country further out west. They like what Iran is doing, sending back Afghan immigrants, arresting them in Iran, even though they have valid legal documents, and then sending them back to Afghanistan and telling them, don't come back. And then Afghans say, but I have a visa. I have a work visa. I have an ID that is still currently valid. Just don't come back. And then you see how these Afghan returnees are being treated on the other side of the border. Often, by the way, as cruelly. And often in ways that are as dehumanizing as those on the Iranian side. And I interview and I quote some people here who say, I'm Farsi speaking. I'm a Shia from around Herat. And I went to Iran thinking I was going to be treated better. They treated me like hell, right? I don't know if I can cuss. They treated me very poorly, basically, is what he said. They're supposedly my quote-unquote brothers, but brothers don't treat each other like this. And so that's why Islam Kala is so fascinating. You have this bad actor, supposedly a rogue regime, as the Bush administration called Iran. You have this problematic country in the world, but actually, you look at that problematic country and you look at another country that the entire world is freaked out about, Afghanistan, and Iran actually turns out to be an ally of global security all of a sudden. It's quite instrumental. So therefore, the lesson is, for global security and for actually for the way that Afghanistan has been controlled, pressured, contained, made to stay where it is, put in place, and made not to move. For that kind of control of Afghanistan, it doesn't matter who global powers are, who the great powers are, whether they're liberal, illiberal, democratic, undemocratic, Western, Eastern, Northern, Southern. It doesn't matter. It can be Russia, it can be China, it can be Iran, it can be Dubai, also very important role in this whole economy of controlling the Afghans. It doesn't matter who they are, as long as they keep the other in their place, they will be useful to global security. Contrary to actually how we think global security really works.
And then so in this border crossing, which is heavily secured for Afghans, very difficult to cross. So what strategies can Daidan still use personally to counter this surveillance or to counter this security?
Yeah. Countering surveillance or devising tactics of counter surveillance is something I discovered when I visited the border crossing and then later on in my interviews back in Herat. All kinds of ways that people work out to evade the security apparatus at the border crossing, right? So when they go to Iran and then they're deported back, they carefully, even though they're going, by the way, you need to be in their shoes and imagine this, right? You're going through tremendous trauma. You've been arrested and you're being sent back to Afghanistan, often without your family, right? They arrested you on the spot, on the construction site where you worked, or they arrested you while your partner, your husband, your wife, whatever, was away. They arrested you in your own backyard and now they're sending you back to Afghanistan. And these people still have the presence of mind to memorize the routes they travel, how things look like around the border, how guards are distributed, how left and right from the border, how far the security checks extend, what happens when they send you over to the Afghan side. And then they keep this sort of very local situational knowledge in mind and they pass it on and they say, listen, you know, if you're being deported back to Afghanistan, don't do A, B, and C, right? Don't say these things. Simple things. Don't let your child use the restroom alone because they might end up being kidnapped and raped. Things as small as that. You would think as, you know, commonsensical. But all of these things help people create, if you will, a stock of knowledge about the border and how the border works. So the next time, when they try to cross perhaps illegally into Iran, they knew better the terrain. So they created this sort of popular narrative about the border, popular counter knowledge about the border that they can then use and exploit to next time get into the country and not get arrested or not get shot at or shot down. and make it further, you know, into Iran and maybe further out west. So they would often use the what they call the toilet paper tactics is one term that I heard for it, which is basically just how they accumulated knowledge about the border over time and how they insisted on not writing it down necessarily, but actually just passing it on. So every next person who has been through the experience of the border adds a little bit of knowledge to it, adds information to it. And so it creates a roll of knowledge about the border that can be unfolded by any user, right? Kind of like a toilet paper, right? But it was important to just not write anything down specifically so it can't be traced back to specific people so that they can be arrested and tortured. Why? Because ordinary Afghans knew that Afghan government is fairly vulnerable and was fairly vulnerable and weak vis-a-vis the Iranian government. They depended on the Iranian government for lots of things. One thing being allowing hundreds of thousands, millions of Afghans to actually stay in Iran and work there as guest workers, right? So for the Afghan government, before the Taliban came back, for the Afghan government to get Iran to allow all of these Afghans to stay in Iran and work there as guest workers, they had to be sort of very accommodating and cooperative with Iran. One of those things meant that if Iran wants intelligence information on who's organizing, you know, illegal crossings, if they want someone punished, if they want information, intelligence, the Afghan government was often very cooperative, right? Afghan intelligence, Afghan police, they were very cooperative, which meant sometimes torturing their fellow Afghans, right? Beating them up, keeping them in jail on no charges whatsoever until they gave up a name. So using torture tactics to mollify the Iranian government. So ordinary Afghans know all of this. They know that they're not safe in Iran, and they know that they're not safe in Afghanistan either. So therefore, any knowledge that they have about the border, any knowledge that they create and that they're going to use down the road to evade security checks, the police and the military, they have to keep it recorded in an informal way, right? It has to be an oral tradition, oral passing down knowledge.
Thank you. Maybe just one last question, because of course we've seen that since you published your book, the context has changed a lot completely in Afghanistan. We've all seen the media reports on the withdrawal of foreign troops and the Taliban taking over Kabul. With the end of this Western intervention and important cuts made in development aid, for example, is Afghanistan still perceived as a country that needs to be protected, actually, or that we need to be protected from?
Yeah, I think in the conclusion, I say that really, not regardless of what happens, but you know, back then I said whether U.S. and NATO troops pull out entirely or they leave some small numbers in the country, and if they pull out, whatever happens with who exactly is in power, the broad strokes, the broad parameters of Afghan's place in the world, they've been set, they've been put in place, and it's been defined what Afghanistan can and is allowed to be. And that basically means, so US and the allies, the UN, they think we spent two decades there. We didn't really transform the country. We didn't really build the state. But that doesn't change much what we want to achieve, which is to keep you there, isolated, but really contained, to make sure you don't get out and your instability doesn't spill over. Those parameters are set in place. So that means that actually the same logic of post-colonial security, giving them a little aid and taking a little aid away from them if they don't behave, creating some education programs, some funding for enterprise and business startups, using these little ways of these little interventions to keep Afghans busy in Afghanistan, that can actually still work even under the Taliban. And they will, for now, the U.S. and the World Bank are saying, oh, no, we will not be releasing any aid to Afghanistan. But give it a little bit of time. Let the Taliban keep fighting ISIS, by the way. And they too, you know, the sort of what is happening in the country, which will be obviously also gross violations of all kinds of human, political, and civil rights, but that will be normalized into Afghanistan good enough. And you will see a reinvention of the strategy that has been attempted in Afghanistan, that was attempted until the Taliban took over again. You will see the reinvention of that same strategy. Do not let them out. Do not give them visa. Do not give them visa-free travel. Keep them in the country. Some keep in the country just by brute force. Others try and co-opt them into some type of civil society. Now under the Taliban, it's going to look a little different, but they can still do some things. And others keeping it in the country through the sheer injection of humanitarian aid, supplanting and partially replacing what the Taliban, as now the government of Afghanistan, the regime, do for ordinary people. And so you will see a combination of strategies that will be reinvented, reworked, and reappropriated for the new time, for a new old Afghanistan. Why? Because, like I said, the parameters have already been put in place. And what Afghanistan can be is pretty much defined.
Thank you very much. So then I would just like to thank you very much for accepting our invitation and for talking about your book. So Afghanistan Under Siege, The Afghan Body and the Post-Colonial Border. There's a few copies here. Otherwise, it can also be purchased online. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nadine. Thank you, Joe Police. Thank you, everyone who came.
Well, thank you very much. And have a great evening, everyone.
Thank you.